One of the things that got to change is what's going on in our homes. You know that less than 10% of kids whose parents go to church have any kind of faith discussion or discussions about values with their parents in the home? Can you imagine that? In other words, we load up the kids in the car and we go to church. We spend an hour or two, we drive home, and then nobody talks about it. Nobody's praying with their kids other than mealtime. Nobody's reading the Bible with their kids. Nobody's on mission doing ministry together with their kids. Less than 10% of kids who go to church are having any kind of religious experience with their parents other than an occasional mealtime prayer. And we wonder why we're losing our own kids. See, we've become a service economy. We've outsourced everything. We've outsourced the care of our lawn. We've outsourced the washing of our windows. We've outsourced our laundry. We take it to the cleaners. And we've outsourced the spiritual formation of our children. Guys, the church does have a job. The job of the church is to equip you as parents to inspire and to nurture the faith of your own children. And we're going to remind you of that again and again and again. More than remind you, we're going to resource you. We're going to train you. We're going to get behind you. We're going to help you. But friends, we cannot do your job for you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Kurt Bruner. Welcome to the podcast. On the way in, you heard from Pastor Steve Stroop of Lake Point Church talking about the challenge we face, even as Christian parents. And that's part of the reason that Steve and I partnered to write a book called It Starts at Home, A Practical Guide to Nurturing Lifelong Faith. And on an earlier episode, Steve talked about intentional couples and how we can be intentional in our marriage and how that becomes a picture of the gospel. And on this edition, we want to talk about intentional parents. What does it look like to be a parent who is intentionally trying to instill solid faith and belief system into their children in the context of the home? And so you're about to hear a message that my wife Olivia and I gave a couple of years ago talking about these themes and the main principles that you'll find in our book. You can read further and go deeper, but for now we'll spend about 25 minutes or so listening to highlights of a presentation we gave from a larger workshop on what it means to be an intentional parent. Have teenagers in your household, we're in this category, would you raise your hand? Woo. Before you put them down, someone near them, just put a hand on them right now. We're going to pray. No, it's actually a fun season. It's just a little more challenging. Children 12 and under, we're in that category also. If you have children 12 and under, let's see your hands. Now, if anyone here has currently or ever in your life has had parents, could you raise your hand? I just want to get a sense that everyone's covered, we're all connected. Which is actually an important statement because the faith experience we had growing up has a profound influence on our experience of the faith today, but also what we do for the next generation, which we want to spend some time on this morning.
Well, Kurt started a little game in our family. We would be in the car, in the minivan, and, you know, things got kind of boring, and so he likes to liven things up. So he would ask the kids a question. So one day he just asked, who's the tallest? And they got all excited. Huh? Oh, Dad is? You know, who's the cutest? And that's always whatever baby we have at the time. You know, Nicole is, or whoever's the baby. You know, who's the funniest? And that was always Dad, actually, until the teenage years. But one day he asked, okay, who's the smartest? I was like, eight.
I thought it was an obvious question with a clear answer.
But our six-year-old Sean at the time sat right up when he said that and said, Mom is! And I was like, smart child. Okay, so I turned to look at Kurt, and he is literally hurt. You could tell by the look on his face. So he turned around to Sean, and he said, Sean, you know, I think Mom's smart. I mean, that's why I married her. I love the fact that she graduated from college, and we have great conversation. But I'm just curious, why did you know so quickly that Mom was the smartest? And he sat right up in that van and said, because she always knows when I have to go to the bathroom.
Hey, the funny thing is she knows when I have to go, too. Moms are amazing. They really are.
You know, the end of that day, I reflect what happened in the van, and I was like, you know, our children really don't care what our degree is. You know, they didn't really care that Kurt was a vice president at Focus on the Family and that he'd written books. They didn't really care where, they never asked us, where did you go to college, Mom and Dad? What they care about is that we want to meet their needs and be aware of their situation and what they need.
A couple of months ago, I walked into our youngest, Nicole, who at 6 years old had started a journal, and she kind of shyly handed it up to me. It was time to tuck her into bed, but she said, "Daddy, you can read this." And so she gave me her little prayer journal that she had begun. She saw that Mom and Dad had a prayer journal, and she wanted one, and so Olivia bought her this. And she had her first entry the first day, 6 years old, and this is what she wrote. "Dear God, I love you, and I believe in you. You are the Lord of everybody in the world. When I'm an adult, I think I will get married. Thank you, Lord, for my mom and dad. Thank you for my home. The most important thing is the Bible. I will miss my mom and dad when they die. But if I get married, I guess I will have fun to hug and kiss my children. I hope I get married, because if I don't, I will have to do all the work." Ladies, I know exactly what you're thinking.
Can't do it anyway.
It's not going to make any difference, sweetie. You're still going to have to do all the work. And then she ended by saying, "I wish Satan was nice." But he's not nice. In fact, one of the areas he's most not nice about is undermining our homes, undermining the experience of the gospel in the context of the family. Perhaps you're aware of some of the lower estimates that are telling us children raised in Christian families in our generation are walking away from the faith at an alarming rate. And some people are saying, "Well, what's the church doing wrong?" And yet, the church has never invested more time, energy, creativity into expressing the gospel in ways that are powerful and impactful. There's something going on here. What is it? And I believe it has to do with missing God's design for how gospel transference occurs. These four flowers would represent my four children. I want nothing in life more than for my children to embrace my faith and my beliefs and for those roots to grow deep. And so I want them to be exposed to the gospel. And so I bring them to the church, which will be represented by this watering pot. And the church, of course, has the living water of the gospel that they teach my children. I bring them over and over, and they hear the gospel. But for some reason, it doesn't seem to be absorbing. It doesn't seem to be part of their experience and their understanding, and they walk away from the faith. So, not to insult our intelligence, we all know what the problem is, don't we? They just need to go to a bigger church is what needs to happen. They need to go to a church that has all kinds of great facilities and programs and maybe even a really cool-looking student pastor or something like that. No. God's design is called the home, the rich soil of the home where faith is nurtured and the roots can grow deep, because the gospel is poured into that context and it's lived on a day-in and day-out basis. It's faith at home that's the critical issue. And we want to talk about four principles of how we instill faith into our children. Exodus chapter 20, it's in the midst of God giving the Ten Commandments, and he makes an incredibly potent statement. "I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God," he says, "punishing the children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments." You read that passage of Scripture and you think, boy, that sounds so harsh. And yet it's a hyperbole. A hyperbole is an exaggerated statement that tells us about a very real principle. And we know it's true, don't we? We know we're part of a multi-generational reality. In fact, the first principle we call the legacy principle, and it goes like this. What we do today will have a direct influence on the multi-generational cycle of family traits, beliefs, and actions, for good or for bad.
Well, the legacy that I received was very negative. I had an alcoholic father who was drunk and would come home, and he was abusive with my mom. My sister was 10. My brothers were 8, 6, 4, and 2. She remembers this specifically because this was a time in my father's life where he was particularly abusive, and he had come home one night, and she didn't want the fight, and he said to her, "Get upstairs to do your wifely duty," and she said, "Okay." She found out a month later she was pregnant with me. She wrote her mother a letter. She lived in New York. Her mother lived in California. She said, "You need to help me get out of this." Her mother said, "Okay, come and we will help you." So she took 5 children, pregnant with me, from New York to California to start on her own. I saw my dad maybe 3 or 4 times in my whole life, and she never remarried. She tried to raise us. She did the very best she could, but what happened was, emotionally, my home became a place that was not safe. I remember specifically coming home one time, and there were policemen in my driveway. I was like, what's going on? And I go in the house, and I found out my brother had taken a bottle of pills and then gone into the neighborhood, and so they were looking for him so they could take him to the hospital. I remember coming home another time and literally finding my mom on top of my brother. They had been in a fist fight. She was trying to get him to calm down about something, and he couldn't. We were the house that if you lived in our neighborhood, you would tell your kids, okay, you can play at any house, but not that one, because you didn't know what was happening at that house. And then spiritually, my spiritual legacy, my mom became very angry and hard toward God. And so she taught me that God was a big mean man in the sky who basically, you know, if you didn't live perfectly, he was going to hit you on the wrist and say, you know, bad girl. And so God was distant and he didn't love me.
Now, my legacy was very, very different than that. I grew up in a pretty solid Christian home. My mom and dad loved each other and still do. They loved us, and we knew it. It was secure. It was stable. They brought us to church regularly because my dad was actually a deacon at the local Baptist church, and so we were there Sunday morning, and they had Sunday night services and Wednesday night, so church was a big part of our life. I will say this, however. My dad always worked two jobs and was always very busy other than church life, and so very rarely did they do anything to incorporate the faith in the home. The one thing they did try, my dad had at his disposal, was something they called family devotions. And that meant once a year when the pastor preached this specific sermon on having a family altar, he would take his seven children and sit us down and try to teach us great pearls of wisdom. And you know what? With seven kids, and we would have rather been getting a filling at the dentist, we could sabotage those things in about 5 days. And so there wasn't a lot incorporated in the home. And what happened for me is that I started to associate the faith as something that's boring. And in fact, that happens quite often with children who grow up in the context of a Christian family. So I didn't have an example of how you incorporate faith in the home. Olivia came from the background she described, and so we came to a point where we recognized, boy, we've got to think through how we're going to do this intentionally. There are a number of people you don't want to hear say, oops. Your barber is one that comes to mind. Your mechanic and your surgeon come to mind. But so do your parents. And yet I think if we're honest with ourselves, many of us as parents and as grandparents will say, oops will be the word that sums up the collective influence I had on my child's faith in the context of the home. Because I'm so busy and I'm so distracted, I haven't created an intentional plan. And being intentional means we can give something different, something better than we might have received. Second principle comes out of a passage, again, that's familiar, Proverbs 22:6, train a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not turn from it. Now, the Proverbs are not a book full of promises. This isn't a guarantee. This isn't a take them to church and you're guaranteed that they're going to have a strong faith when they grow up. The Proverbs are a book filled with principles. Odds are, in your favor, that your children will embrace your faith. But what makes the difference? What makes the critical difference? Well, we call that the likelihood principle. In the context of strong relationships, children tend to embrace the beliefs and values of their parents.
So when we realized this, and Kurt and I decided, okay, we want to be intentional. So we thought, what should we do? Well, let's look at some families that we want to be like when we grow up. You know, older families that had children that were grown, and they weren't perfect families, but they were families that worked together, worked through conflict, they loved each other, they even had some rebellion at times with children, but they hung in there, and they had seemed to have very strong relationship, and faith seemed to take place at the home. So we interviewed them, we sat down with them, we had a list of questions, and we asked, okay, how did you do this, and what happened here, and what happened there? And we found it very interesting because all of the methods that they used were different. There's no cookie cutter approach. You have to do it this way. You know, all the methods were different. But there was one common thread through all those families. And we found that very interesting. Guess what it was? Laughter. Fun. They enjoyed each other. They didn't take themselves too seriously. They had a good time together, and at all costs, they made sure the relationship was strong, no matter what was happening.
Now, for many of us, you may be like me, and that's not as natural for you. Again, I didn't grow up in a family where I played with my dad very much at all because he was so busy. And so I wasn't used to being in a context where a lot of that kind of thing would go on. So we would tag team because Olivia, I may be the funny one, but she's the fun one.
Woo-hoo.
And so she would remind me of it's time to have fun with the kids because if they enjoy my company, they're much more likely to embrace my faith. And so a strong relationship is so foundational. And yet, enjoying my company is not enough, because we are in the midst of a spiritual battle, which leads us to what we call the lenses principle. Our children need the corrective lenses of truth to navigate the deceptive roads of life. We're not in a neutral world. We're in a world that has an enemy that seeks to devour and destroy the beliefs of our children. I had a seminary professor who used to say, you know, if you're tempted, you know it. If you're abused or if you're oppressed, you know it. But if you're deceived, you don't know it. And that's what makes it such a powerful weapon in the hands of the enemy of our children's souls.
So how does this play out at home? Well, it's exhausting to tell you the truth. I mean, our children get lies at every stage of their life, everywhere from our girls being told if you're not a size 4 and you're skinny and you don't look a certain way, then you're not worth anything.
They'll come home from school and they picked up a view that I have to choose between science and religion. And we pause and we say, whoa, wait a minute. We need to talk about this. No, God is the God of natural revelation. And that's what science comes from. And so it all comes from Him, as well as special revelation. And that's where religion comes from. And they're all from the same God. And it is exhausting, because you say, how many lies do I have to counter? And it's nonstop. And then there's a final principle, which is where it gets fun.
This is the learning principle. Our children only learn what we teach them in a manner that will reach them. There is no cookie cutter method. Again, we have different people in our homes. We have different schedules in our home. Our children are different. If you have more than one child, you know they have totally different personalities. And what might work for one doesn't work for the other. And so it will look different, and you have to realize that.
Well, in fact, another thing you have to recognize is we have to recognize as parents and as grandparents and those influencing the next generation is they are in different seasons themselves. The first window of opportunity is what we call the imprint period, roughly till about age 7. During this season of parenting, our children are very much the same in that if mom or dad says it, it's good enough for me and I believe it. And we love that period of parenting. Then they turn roughly around 7, depends on the child, and they enter what we call the impression period. Now, this is actually the most important window of spiritual influence in our children's lives, because they are now able to start to engage and understand and even push back and question what we're talking about and teaching them, and yet they're also mature enough to embrace it as their own. And so there's the impression window. And by the way, the imprint period and the impression period are the two windows of opportunity when the overwhelming majority of those who ever come to faith in Christ do so. And guess what? It's also the window of time when we're crazy in our schedules, we're running them here, there, and everywhere, and we're least intentional so often. Now, when they become teenagers, it changes. They enter a coaching period. It's no longer an instruction process, but it's their game, and we're coaching them as they try and play out and live out what it is that they've learned.
So now comes the fun part. We're going to talk to you guys about ways to be intentional. Now, before we do this, do not walk out of the church today and say, okay, I got to do these 77 ideas this week with my family, all right? We do not want you to do that. What we want you to do is listen, go, okay, what would work for me? What could I incorporate in my home during the time that I'm already doing that I can fit to pass my faith on to my children?
In fact, let's start out with bedtime. You're already going to be doing something, particularly if you have younger children, at bedtime. You're going to be getting 7 glasses of water. You're going to be threatening their lives, okay? You might as well squeeze in some spiritual discussion time as well, or readings, or we do something called bedtime blessings on our children occasionally, where you're taking advantage of that time just before they lie down.
One thing that I did, I realized that the children, I don't know why it is, but right when you're saying goodnight, honey, is when they go, Mom, 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 and they have like 20 questions to ask you, and sometimes they're very serious. Why does God do this, and what happened about this? But I think what happens is the quieting of their spirit. They finally are resting, and they can think. And so I thought to myself, first of all, it's driving me crazy, because I was thinking, I have got dishes to do. I got to go to bed. So how can I take advantage of this but not wear myself out? So when they were little, I said, all right, this is what we're going to do. You have me on Tuesday night, and you have me on Wednesday night. And after I get you guys settled...
And I wondered, when was my night?
After I get you guys settled, then I'm gonna give you 15 minutes. And they're like, really? Yes, I'm going to lay with you, or I'm going to sit by your bed. You can ask me whatever you want. And you get me for 15 minutes solid. And then the other one has another night. Now, the great part was, if I tried to get out of it, guess what they did? No, Mom, it's Tuesday night. This is my night. And so it really held me accountable to spend some one-on-one time with them. We were already going to bed. And then what was great is on Friday night, I could say, good night, honey. It's not your night tonight.
So there's bedtime. Then there's mealtime. Very, very important, by the way. All of the studies say the same thing, that if you want to raise children who avoid many of the risky behaviors, the most important characteristic is that you're a family that has dinner together at least 3, 4, 5 times per week. And so you try to make that a priority where we're eating together, because it's in that context that so many of the dialogues occur. We do something in our dinner table time called high-low, where we simply say high-low, and everyone knows what that means. That means each of us go around and we talk about the high point of our day and the low point of our day. Very simple to do. They anticipate it every mealtime. You'll be amazed the things that come out when you do that little activity. A lot of times it's just fun. Sometimes some very serious discussions about a low point come out that we need to engage on. Some of these lies that need to be corrected surface during those dinner time discussions and eating together.
Okay, now let's talk about that passage where it says you walk along the road. We don't walk anywhere. So we say that the new translation of that is when you ride in your minivan or when you ride in your SUV, because we drive everywhere. So use your drive time. We've done everything from just Christian songs to we do Adventures in Odyssey. When the kids were little, we did something called Jungle Jam. And then as they got older, we listened to books on tape or the Chronicles of Narnia together. If we got an hour in the car with the kids, we don't want to waste it.
Holidays are a great opportunity.
And I think what's really important at the holidays is to make sure your calendar has some time on it for your family. We can just fill up that calendar at the holidays and we don't have any faith passing time, even though it's such a natural time to do it. Well, one Easter we decided, okay, tonight we're going to do this at home, and Kurt just thought, I'm going to go out and get some wood, and he came home and we made a cross. And we talked to them about what the cross was, and we read some scriptures, and they love to use a hammer and a nail, so that was really fun. But we made it fun, and then we talked about it. And then at the end, we all took a piece of paper and wrote down the sins that we knew we had dealt with that week or that year or whatever. And we talked about, you know what, we're going to nail those sins to the cross because Jesus takes our sins from us.
So holidays, you capture those moments. As our boys, older boys, entered the teen years, we moved into a process where we use movie nights, where we enjoy watching a movie together. So we'll go find a film. I'll go find a film that touches in some way upon an aspect of what we believe for discussions about how does that contrast or undermine what we believe or support what we believe and so forth. So again, just another vehicle, another tool for enjoying time together, something you're going to do anyway, pop the popcorn and then have a discussion. Now, something that's worked in our home for over a decade in the various ages of our children is something I learned from actually a business associate who kept talking about some of these things he was doing with his kids on family night, and I had never heard of it, and so our oldest was 5 at the time, and I listened and I said, boy, I'm going to try that. And family nights is simply a time that you set apart one evening per week. Why do you set it apart one evening per week? Because then you'll get to it about every other week in light of the schedule realities. And that's what happens for us. We don't feel guilty about it, but that's 26 impression opportunities that we get to have that wouldn't have been if it hadn't been on the schedule. And all it is we play a theme song, and everyone knows the family night theme song. It's an upbeat song, and so that means you gather in the living room. It's family night time, which is the favorite time of the week. And we'll dance around somewhat crazy, and we'll take the younger kids, and we'll swing them up and down and throw them on the couch, hopefully hitting the couch, you know. And, but we have a blast just getting in the mood for this is the great time. It's when we're going to deal with our faith as a family. And so very unlike what I grew up with, we wanted to make it the highlight of the week rather than the low point of the week. So then we will do an object lesson-based activity that has some aspect of our faith tied to it. So, for example, our very first family night was when Kyle was 5 and Sean was 3. And I said to Kyle, all right, Kyle, how do we know God is real when we can't see him? Well, that's a good question, Dad, for a 5-year-old trying to figure that one out. Well, let's think about it. Is there anything else that's real that we can't see? Well, air is real and we can't see that, right? That's right. So then we pulled out a little balloon and had an activity, and I started to blow up the balloon.
Now the 3-year-old's engaged, okay? Once he pulled out that balloon, our 3-year-old, you know, had no idea what we were talking about, but who cares? Dad's got a balloon. And Dad started saying, okay, now what else does air have? It has power. It has power to blow up a balloon.
In fact, let's see how much power it has, and then we'd let go of the balloon. All right, now, the problem is for the next 15 minutes, I blew up 475 balloons. Do it again, Dad. Do it again, Dad. And we'd race to see how far our balloons would shoot and so on and so forth. But to give them a sense of air is real, air has power, even though you can't see it. And then we simply sat down and looked at the scripture that says God is a spirit. That's why we can't see him. And we always end our family nights with a jingle, a little rhyme or jingle to help us embed in our minds what it was about. And this one was, just like air, God is there. Over a decade later, if you ask our oldest boys about their first family night, they'll be able to tell you, well, it's just like air, God is there. What does that mean? Well, God is real. Just because you can't see him doesn't mean he's not real. There are a lot of things that are real that we can't see. We captured that imprint and impression window in their lives to make it common sense that, of course, God is real even though you can't see him. And yet there are people in their 80s and 90s still wrestling with that issue of, how could God be real when I can't see him? So we capture those limited windows we have when children are young by creating experiences in the context of the home.
Okay, we did another one, which was really fun. We were having a bit of an issue with bickering. I don't know if you guys ever have that with your siblings. Yes. So we thought, we need to do a family night on this. So Kurt went and got toothpaste tubes and some plates. So he lines them up at the counter, and he gives them all a toothpaste tube, and he puts a plate in front of each one of them. And he pulls out his wallet, and he says, okay. Slams it down on the counter, and he says, okay, you guys, the first person to get all the toothpaste out of that tube gets a dollar. And they were like, yeah, how fun. And they start squeezing, you know, and our house smells like minty fresh, you know, and it's just so fun. And so then they're squeezing, and then Nicole gets it out. Yay, I won, you know, and she's all excited, I won. And they're thinking, okay, family night, that was fun, Dad. And he goes, no, wait a minute.
Okay, so then I pull out my wallet. I reach in for a $20 bill, slap it on the table. First one to get it back into the tube gets the $20.
And they were so excited. So he goes, okay, go. So we had given them some utensils, like a straw and a toothpick, and they're shoving it in there, you know, trying to get it in. And they could not get it in, but he tried for like 5 minutes. He just let them have fun with it. It made a mess. And then he said, okay, time's up. And they're like, it's impossible. We can't get it back in.
It's not possible. Well, that's just like your tongue. Once words come out, there's no way to take them back in. And we looked quickly at the scripture. And then we went to our jingle, which was, do it God's way. Watch what you say. It can also be as basic as this. I'm tired. I don't want to have to do a complicated family night, but it is that time. And so let's just go to ice cream. But before going to ice cream, here's what we're going to do. I walk to the top of the stairs. The kids and mom are down at the bottom of the stairs. And I said, listen, if you can figure this one out, we're going to go to ice cream together. All right? So I am God in heaven. I'm like God in heaven. And I want you where I am. I want you to be with me here. Now, you can't touch the stairs and you can't touch the railing. Figure out how you're going to get up here. Well, some silence, some scratching of the head, this is impossible, Dad. How are we supposed to get up and, oh, wait a minute. And my oldest figures it out. He says, all right, Dad, I'm in. Come down the stairs. So I walk down the stairs. He gets on my back. Now carry me up the stairs. And we go to the top of the stairs. 2 minutes, we talk about the fact that why did Christ have to come down to us to accomplish what we couldn't accomplish on our own? And that's what the gospel's about. Now, off to ice cream. It can be that simple, but you create those experiences and those moments, the formal moments that set up all kinds of informal conversations. The scriptures say this, and we end with Psalm 78. He commanded our forefathers to teach their children so the next generation would know them, even the children yet to be born, and they in turn would tell their children. Then they would put their trust in God. Well, as I mentioned at the beginning, the book It Starts at Home is available now for those who want to go deeper on any of the themes we described here, and we give far more practical ideas of how you can make that a reality in your family. We also discuss spiritual formation at home. What does that concept mean, and why is the family the primary context of our faith formation? Steve Stroop talks about intentional couples, how we can create a God-honoring marriage. We have a section for intentional grandparents, for those who are in that situation, as well as a section for intentional leaders, those who want to create a culture of intentionality and who want to understand some of the sociological trends and faith perspective trends that are influencing this whole dynamic of faith in the home. Thanks for listening. We'll see you soon.